This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good afternoon. Thank you all for joining us today. It's hard for me to believe that it's been 20 years since our founding teacher passed away. And it makes this a difficult weekend for me, perhaps for some of you. In the first years after Coben passed, I used to lead the memorial. I did that for several years. There were not many people living at Jikoji then. I think that was before Doug came. And Mike used to sometimes take some vacation in July, and so he would ask me to come and lead this. And it was just an informal, we wouldn't do a whole session, we would do just a one-day sitting on Saturday, and then we would do a little service on Sunday. And usually the talk I would give would just be the story of how I met Coben and the short time that I spent with him. Then after a few years, we started to do a little more. We had a very large commemoration at the 10th anniversary of his passing. And we published a book with lots of people's remembrances of Coben, which includes my story of how I met him. And so now that anyone who wants to know that story can just read it, I feel funny just telling the same story again each year. We actually thought about doing a larger commemoration this year, but the combination of the COVID pandemic, and so it being difficult to invite guests from far and have a large crowd here, and we were told by the local Soto bishop, Genjo Kiburoshi, that in Japan, 20 is not a particularly important anniversary. In Japan, it would be quite inappropriate to do a big event at the 20th. And he explained that the tradition in Japan would be to do a large gathering on the 23rd anniversary, which felt like good news since it gives us three more years to prepare. And we can hope that perhaps things will be a little more normal in 3 years. But I've been thinking about Coben a lot this week. I think I was one of the last students that he ordained as a priest. I don't know if I was the very last. He was very much of a traveling teacher in the last few years of his life. And so I don't know if there's any one person who knows everything that he was doing, because he would visit Jikoji, he would visit his temple in Taos, he spent a lot of time in Boulder, he spent some time in Santa Cruz, and spent quite a bit of time in Europe. And it was a bit of a transition period for him. we met in the mid-90s. And he was sort of retired at that point. I think it would have been fine with him if people had stopped asking him to teach. But he ended up getting remarried and starting another family, and that seemed to give him new energy. And so I sort of caught him just as he was in this sort of second renaissance of starting to teach more, have more students. He was starting to lead sessions at Jikoji again, much more regularly. And there was even talk that we might build a house here so that he could live here permanently. And there were some plans underway to pursue that. But I think he was still a little unsure of how much he wanted to be a teacher. He had at that point been doing it for quite a long time. It's strange for me to think about how young he was when he first came to the States and began teaching. He was just in his late 20s. I feel somehow we'd be surprised these days to go to a Zen center and see that the master was 28. But that's how old he was. And yet, from those who knew him then, he was already a commanding presence. By the time I met him, he was, I think, just a little bit older than I am now. So he was in his mid-50s. And so had already been teaching in this country for 25 years or so. And was sort of trying to figure out what was next for him. With this kind of rebirth that had happened, his new family, this new schedule. So when he did or agree to ordain me, he placed two conditions, both of which were a little surprising to me at the time. So the first was that he wanted me to sew my own okesa. It's not this one, it's my old one, but he wanted me to sew it myself, which is traditional. But the rumor in those days was that he just had a drawer full of okesas and he would just give you one. So that's what I thought was going to happen, and he didn't. He wasn't going to let me off so easy. And he had a relationship with the sewing teacher at the San Francisco Zen Center, Blanche Hartman. And so he told me I should get in touch with her and she would teach me how to sew the okesa. So that was the first condition. The second condition was that he wanted me to take responsibility for my own training, that he would ordain me, but he wouldn't train me. That was also surprising. And at first, it was this first condition that worried me, because I had never really sewn anything before. And it ended up taking me actually several years to sew the okesa. I would go to Green Gulch, one of the Zen Center temples. I think every Sunday, and after the public lecture, there would be a little group of people sewing. And I remember it took me so long that I outlasted several sewing teachers. So it went from Blanche, I think, to someone else, and then to Galen, to the point where no one could quite remember why I was coming there to sew. But I kept going, and I did eventually complete it, I think, with Galen. And once I was done, we scheduled the ordination, and it took place here, right, the middle of the Zendo. Kobin brought his family, his two kids that he had at the time. both very small. I think one was a baby and one was just a toddler. And just by chance, the weekend that had worked out for Coben, my own father was in town, so he came to my ordination, which was really special. But after the ordination, this second condition that Coben placed on me, it became clear that that was really the more significant one. And he really meant it. I was welcome to come and sit sesshins with him and things and do dokusan now and then, and we did that. But he didn't have a formal program for training priests, and he really did expect us to find our own way. And I think that was really one of the very unique and precious things about Coben. Many of the Zen temples and centers and institutions started to become somewhat bureaucratic and had whole systems of training. And he had spent several years at Eheiji, which has a very structured system of training. And that somehow didn't interest him. He appreciated the forms and rituals of Zen, but he didn't like having a lot of rules and having a lot of structure. And he really encouraged his students to be out in the world, like him, to marry, to have families, if that's what they wanted, often to work. And to work out that balance between practice and everything else in their life, for themselves. And this has made me think a lot recently about the role of teachers. That ordination, that was, I guess, about 24 years ago and since then, I've now become a teacher. And we still at Jokoji try to honor Coben's spirit of just enough form, just enough ritual, but not too much structure, not too many rules. And I think it is a tricky balance that we continue to wrestle with. One of the most common questions I get when I teach, is some variation of how do I know that it's working? When will I start to feel different? How long do I need to do this? And I think there's a strong desire in many of us for structure, for some sense of progress and accomplishment. And sometimes, even for myself, I am almost a little jealous of the Rinzai tradition, where you have these 100 or 200 koans and you work through them one by one. And at some point, you're done with the first one, and then you're done with the second one, and then you're done with the 50th one, the 60th one, the 100th one. And I think it must be nice to be done with something. And I remember reading that in one of the Rinzai Sanghas, in like the Sangha newsletter, they published the names of the people who finished their first koan. Again, giving them, I'm sure, this sense of accomplishment. But our way and Koban's way is really quite different. And we try to preserve this space in our practice, in the Zendo, on our cushion, as sort of one place in life where there is no accomplishment, where there is no progress. We try not to distinguish between good practice and bad practice, or experienced practice and beginner's practice, that we all just practice. We all just find our own way. And it's a little mysterious what happens. It feels wrong in some ways to say that nothing happens, that nothing changes. But equally wrong to say that something happens and something changes. I imagine Koban's practice when I met him in his 50s was not exactly the same as it was when he first arrived in his 20s. But it's hard to pinpoint what the difference really is. Other traditions of Buddhism, particularly the Tibetan lineages, they have all these different practices that they work through. You might start with one and work your way to others. But again, we just have our one practice that we continue all our life. I also wonder sometimes what Jokoji would be like, what our Sangha would be like if Koban was still with us, if perhaps he had decided to move here again, we'd built him a house. But it's really impossible to know. He seemed to be someone who didn't like to stay anywhere for too long. And so, probably, if we had built that house 20 years ago, he would have moved out of it by now and would be doing something else. And this life that he led of moving around, starting temples, leaving temples, working with students, leaving them to their own way. It is an important reminder that everything changes, that he wouldn't want us to freeze Jokoji as it was 20 years ago, 40 years ago, 5 years ago. He would have expected us to keep changing as much as he kept changing. Trying new things, experimenting, moving around. And I think we try to honor that spirit here. As I said, even the structure of these memorials has shifted in the 20 years since his passing. And they'll continue to shift. They provide us this nice opportunity to remember the spirit that birthed this temple and renew our commitment to the continual rebirth of it and the continual rebirth of our practice here. And although I'm always sad in these weeks leading up to the memorial, I don't know that Koban himself would be sad. He did lead a truly amazing life, traveled far. He touched many people. He wasn't perfect. And he deserves to be remembered with all his imperfections, too. And I think we honor his spirit best by just trying to continue his work. Doing the practice, teaching the practice, keeping these temples alive, keeping them growing and changing. Reaching new students, establishing new traditions. Raising new teachers. The last couple years have been a time of tremendous change for all sorts of reasons. Of course, the pandemic brought many challenges, but Jikoji has also had other changes. Our longtime resident teacher retired. And four of us were asked to step in to continue holding the practice here. We have fewer and fewer among us who practiced and spent time with Koban directly. In some ways, Koban has transitioned from being a teacher to being a lineage. And it's up to us to think about what that lineage will represent. what these temples will represent. Even his example, in some ways, starts to fade. As again, there's fewer and fewer people who practiced with him directly. And so what we're left is the practices, the forms, the rituals he gave us. And I think this spirit of experimenting, of changing, making mistakes. Changing things again. Trying to respond to each moment. Trying to bring authentic practice to each moment. I'm very grateful for the short time I had to practice with Komen. And for what he's left us here, so that we can continue that practice. Each year we mark his passing, but each year also we welcome more people into his Sangha. Because now that he's gone, we can't rely on him to carry this practice for us. We have to carry it ourselves. So I'm just so grateful to all of you joining us here this weekend and helping us carry Komen's practice together. We have a little more time if anyone has questions or anything they'd like to say or share. Yes, please.
I never knew Komen. I'm glad he found this place for me to find. But I would challenge the assumption that you can't measure the change with Soto Zen. Well, we don't have the steps as in Rinzai and Tibetan, where you do this, you do this, you do this. But I'm not the same person when I walk through the door now, a few years apart. I mean, I'm different. I'm different. I don't think I could go back to what I was unaware. You know, I think that's what the great thing is. You know, I'm more aware, I'm awake, more awake. And I think everyone has to practice this. I don't know what enlightenment means, I have no clue, but I think, which seemed to me profound, I am not the same person. I'm just not. But what a legacy you left, huh? Well, glad you got to know him. Thanks for the talk.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, it's certainly not that we don't change. One of the fundamental truths of Buddhist teachings is that everything changes. You know, people will sometimes ask me when I'm teaching if I feel different now that I've started meditating. And I tell them, I started meditating when I was 19. So yes, I feel different. but I think I would feel different anyways. So it's a little hard to know how much is the meditation and how much is that I'm not 19. And, you know, one of the strange realities of life is you can't do controlled experiments. You know, you can only try one thing. So we're trying this thing. And we see the results. We don't really know what would happen if we tried something else. But we hope that this path that we're on leads somewhere. Thank you. Yes.
One of the things, many things that I remember Colby saying since I met him in 76, it just dropped a hint over and over again, is that he didn't come here to make us Japanese Buddhists or Japanese Zen students. He wanted us to find our way. And Suzuki Roshi said that quite succinctly in the epilogue of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, that we have to develop our way. I haven't seen much of that happen in the 46 years. And I'm wondering, you and two other guiding teachers here, have any thoughts on that? If you've heard that message or received it, and where are we at now as a sangha? The sangha, well, Kogan's been, if not Soto Zen in North America. Do you teachers talk about that in terms of carrying on? If I'm hearing correctly, Kobe had that wish or suggestion. Where are we on that now?
Well, we do talk about it, and I know I think about it a lot. And you know, it's a tricky balance to try to figure out. You know, although Kobe said that, he did introduce certain forms here that he felt, I think, were useful. He often adapted them. So, for example, the Orioki that we do, which I think he more or less invented, is the simplified form of the much more elaborate Orioki that they did at Eheiji. It has fewer bowls and fewer things. But of course, he didn't have to teach anybody any kind of Orioki. I guess he thought it was useful to have some kind of eating form to encourage mindfulness, to have that sense of eating as a ritual, perhaps. And similarly, the services we do here are much simpler even than the services they do at the San Francisco Zen Center, which are simpler than the services they do at Japanese temples. But we still do something. And try to figure out what are the essential forms, if there are any essential forms, and what are the ones that we should reinterpret. I find it very hard to know. In the Pali Canon, you know, Buddha, it said during his lifetime, created all of these rules for the monks and nuns, 243 or so rules for the monks and additional rules beyond that for the nuns. But then as he was dying, I think on his last day, one of the things he said is that, you know, the Sangha should feel free to change any of the minor rules. And it that, you know, that statement is preserved in the Pali Canon. But when everybody met after Buddha passed, they just decided there was no way to know which rules were minor, and so they didn't change any of them, and they still won't change them. So that's sort of an extreme form. And in some ways, I feel it's not being true to what the Buddha asked. He asked them to continue to adapt these rules, and they've refused to do that. And you could say the same about Koban, that he asked us to adapt this, and we've not been, I don't know, aggressive enough in trying to adapt it. But on the other hand, you know, he asked me to sew an okesa. He seemed to think it was important for me to have one, so I've kept wearing it. So I just think it is a challenge. I think probably our practice here is not exactly the same as it was when Koban was alive. I think we do a little more English in our services than he used to do. But you're right that it's not tremendously different. But I would love to hear more of your thoughts about it.
And I'm interested in more Kokyo's teaching, your practice with Suzuki Roshi and that alone, all that lineage has dealt with this. But to answer your question off the top of my head, you know, you said, you know, wants us to continue the practice, to promulgate it, to share it. I'm wondering how attractive it is to new generations of practitioners with the Japanese baggage. We continue to attract people to Shikantaza, you know, translating that to just sitting. We have something important to pass on, to share, to practice. We put it in a way that's going to appeal to the millennials. We're not here to proselytize. People who encounter Zen, they choose to do it or not do it, but would there be more of an inclination to people to look into it if we weren't so Japanese?
I guess I often feel the opposite, which is there are so many people out there teaching meditation now, including many that teach it without these sorts of forms. You know, you can become a meditation teacher now by going and getting a master's at Brown University. They have a master's in mindfulness meditation. And you can become a completely secular teacher. Even within the Buddhist tradition, you can go to the Insight or Goenka sanghas, and you can practice where nobody's wearing robes and nobody's, in many cases, not chanting or doing anything else. So people who want to sit without the Zen forms, they have so many opportunities to do that. So why offer another? There's enough. But we have something different we can offer. We have this 1,000 or so year tradition of certain forms, certain rituals, which some people like. You know, for me, it was part of what attracted me to Zen. I wanted to dress up in funny robes. It was appealing. The first time I saw a Zen monk, who was at my university, there was one who was visiting. And I just thought, that's what I want to be. I want to be that. So, I mean, if no one was coming, then I would feel that you're right, that I guess maybe the the moment has passed. People aren't interested in this, and so they're sort of voting with their feet for some of those other traditions. But I don't feel that's what's happening. Our Sunday programs are quite full. This session was at capacity. I had to change the website to tell people they couldn't sign up anymore. So why not preserve this tradition that people seem to like and want, and let other teachers transmit a different style of practice?
But didn't Koban and Suzuki Roshi challenge us to adapt culturally? Even though there were other sanghas already further ahead in adaption, or maybe they just started from a different base.
Right, the question is just
have we... throw it out there. Not,
yeah, I hear you, and I think about it all the time. The question is just have we adapted enough, and is something lost if we adapt too much? Yes, please.
I feel if we go through life, we go through life, and in order to do anything, it needs to address the issue of death, because that's exactly where we're going towards. And if we don't know what's cutting through death, it's a total waste of time, ultimately, to engage in anything, because you need to know, you know, the purpose of life and the issue of death. That's exactly, and if you're in the Buddhist tradition, we are talking about discovering the deathless bottom line. So I was always intrigued when we were in Oyoki meals, and it says very clearly often, our Buddha way, you know, I eat this meal in order to accomplish our Buddha way. And I remember in the past, like coming to Kochi and hearing this exact translation kind of thing, and I was like, why is it, you know, say, why does it underline that in all these, in this Oyoki meal? And just the other session, I realized actually way is just the Chinese version for mind. And so if anything we are receiving this meal and doing this practice, it's about discovering our Buddha mind. So sometimes I wonder, maybe we're just lost in translation to some extent, you know, and really wanting to still unearth, you know, what was being intended here in picking up these practices and introducing us to these forms. Because, you know, if you're in touch with our Buddha mind, that's very, very rich, and it's really enlightening, and it definitely will lead us to the deathless right there and then. So we can just like re-engage the conversation about what we're doing here over and over again, and then come to this insight.
Thank you. Kokyo, I think Peter was also inviting you if you had any thoughts on this you wanted to share.
Well, I think Peter had a great question, and I think about it too. And also I see it in these relative terms. So coming from some practice in Japanese monasteries and places like Tassahara, I think of Jikoji as very adaptive, very Americanized. So it's just so relative, right? But then I could see how one could see, if one comes from that kind of mindfulness tradition, it would look very, could look Japanese or formal, traditional. So I think it's an open question, and I think Michelle's point of, well, what's it really about is the bottom line, what's the deepest intention? And another thought, sometimes I have is, I've heard some people say that, well, maybe eventually American Buddhism will be like one thing, it will be like one kind of lineage, indistinguishable, because we have all this Theravada and Zen and Tibetan, that in another 100 years, I've heard some people predict, it'll all mesh together and be American Buddhism. And when I hear that, I think, I don't think it will ever happen. And if it did, that would be kind of sad, I feel, because it's the uniqueness of all the different lineages and traditions that's so beautiful. And if there's, if we only had one, or only one was allowed in America, maybe that wouldn't be so appropriate. But there's such an array, and they're so different. Just like Christianity has all these different branches and divisions, and somebody might say we should just have one Christianity and its updated form or something. But for people who are immersed in all the different Christian sects, they probably appreciate that there's all that diversity too. So, but I think looking at forms and Japanese forms is a good one to, because sometimes I feel like there's some forms we do that don't really have a function. We're just doing them because we inherited them. And then some that maybe do have a practice function. And how to tell the difference is quite hard, I think.
Yeah.
So some things I think of is the kind of practices and forms from the Buddha's time that have continued to the present through these radically different cultures of India, China, and Japan. They probably had these same questions when Indian Buddhism came to China. Such different cultures, radically different cultures, and yet some things stuck and some changed. Like the clothing changed, but still there was that patch robe seems to have made it from the time of Buddha up till now. And our like sitting posture and things like this. Many things. I think some kind of ritual offerings to Buddha, I guess weren't actually in the Buddha's time, but except offering the Shakyamuni Buddha his meal. But soon after he was gone, this reciting the teachings and offering incense and bowing are, I think, 2,500 years old and were done in different languages and different styles, but made it through as maybe essential elements. So I think that's an interesting one to look at too, is rather than cultural Japanese things, what types of practices have made it through all these different cultures. Mm-hmm. Just some thoughts, but it's a great question, I think. No easy answers.
I like what you said about thinking about each form, each ritual, what purpose does it serve for us, or how does it serve us now? You know, I remember when you sort of formally complete training and become a teacher, there's these rituals, and one of them is to write out the lineage. So you start with Buddha, then Buddha student, and disciple, all the way, you know, through to Dogen, and eventually, you know, myself in this case. And I thought I liked that ritual. It was very difficult, but I felt this connection with the lineage. It felt very meaningful, and I felt I got a lot out of that. And then when all that is over, you meet with your teacher all alone in the middle of the night in a little room. And I thought, this is weird. I'm not sure that we need to keep this ritual going. This feels completely bizarre. And so I don't know. I think some of them maybe aren't serving us anymore, and we should ask ourselves. You know, when I do the service, I really only use English chants, because I just find doing a chant that nobody in the room understands to me doesn't feel like right form. But other people like doing the Japanese chants, and they like the sounds, and you know, the same sounds that people have been chanting for, again. Well, yeah, I do think it's hard. I don't know, Carolyn or Doug, would you like to share that?
It's a very rich discussion, and I thank Peter and everyone, Toho and Kokio and you, for speaking on it. And I yes, we think about it, and we talk about it. We are in a new, this is a very, this in itself, moving in a year from a long established one guiding teacher to a collective, if you will, of guiding teachers. We're just called the guiding teachers. We don't have a name of the council or anything, but that already is a very large change in my view, in any case. It takes time to move a 1,000-year-old ship, to steer the rudder in a little bit different direction. We do look at that. And picking up a thread that you have mentioned and Kokio has mentioned, and actually Shoho mentioned too, the thread of language, which is what I've been thinking about in this discussion. So one way that Dan mentioned specifically the chanting, which I also chant in English, but it's also how I think Buddhism has survived and spread for, beginning with Shakyamuni Buddha himself, who valued language and knew how to use it, and used it masterfully, like Dogen does in a different way, according to his audiences. He spoke with many different people of many different classes in many different places. And so what the language we use when we teach and when we talk about what we're doing, I think is a very important way that we are, that traditions get carried on, yet adapt to the culture that they're in.
Thank you. Doug, would you like to share some thoughts?
The core of this practice, as Shoho mentioned, is about life and death. And I think what sustained this place for its 40 years now of Jokoji, initially with Angie in leading, Sashin, Mike for 17 years, and now here we are, is Zazen, and that indefinable practice, I think, is what will keep this place going. And it's Sashin after Sashin, period of Zazen after period of Zazen, that attracts difficult people. All of us here are difficult, complicated people to this place, in this and then there are all these other limitations of place, we are so fortunate to be in this valley of practice that has been that way for thousands of years with our predecessors in the valley. According to Koban, stories say that he mentioned that this is a place of practice for other peoples. So there's some magic that happens But it's this core practice of meeting our life on the cushion that we get to interpret it as we best can. Dan, you mentioned about authentic, being authentic. And in the middle of the afternoon on a hot day, there are a lot of more pleasant places to be than in the Zendo in pain with your body and mind, and yet people show up. So to me, that's the core of it for us. And that we can keep this practice going. It will, we sit and face the wall. That hasn't changed a whole lot. And San Francisco Zen Center, I mean, Santa Barbara Zen Center came from some white plum lineage where people sit and face each other in the Zendo. That's fine too. But authentic practice and to investigate the meaning of our life. And one of the things we're going to hear tomorrow is Coben talking about how this Zazen is the transmission of the Dharma. By taking this posture, we can experience the transmission of the Dharma, each person, whatever that means. I'm still looking at that. I think it'll be that way forever.
I don't know, sitting facing the center, I think that goes too far. I didn't realize we had heretics.
Go for it. My friend Satya is on the phone. He was a priest ordained in Coben, and he's, I think,
interesting. He wants to speak.
Okay. Please.
Unless Kokyo is not done.
I'm done.
So thank you for letting me speak. I didn't know if online people could. I had considered coming down there, but it's a long trip from Portland, and I'm not often using car transportation or planes, so didn't work out this time. But I'm very fond of Jokoji. I've lived there several times over the years, and it's such a beautiful place, and I'm glad that you're all upkeeping it and keeping the practice going and keeping the memory of Coben stirred up.
Good to see you, Sasha.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, Shoho and Kokyo are good friends of mine. I met Shoho before she met Kokyo at the Hurig, one of Coben's branch places, and years ago in my Japanese phase. But I really, I'm happy this discussion came out, and I'm happy Peter brought it up. I don't know if Peter remembers me. I don't know what name I had when we used to practice together, Peter, but I might have been Bimpu or Matt, I don't remember who that was. Yeah. But I just wanted to say that the way I remember Coben, or how he struck me or drew me in the most, was his unpredictability and mysteriousness and artistic way of living his life. And, I think a lot of us, myself included, although I don't do this intentionally, when we give talks to other people, if we've had Coben's influence, we tend to talk really slowly with big gaps of time because he did that. But that can be beautiful, especially if you're saying really weird things slowly. That's what he did, and that was really nice. But what I think stayed with me mostly is his dynamism, which you can see in a lot of his calligraphy. And, you know, he also was like an adventure skier with Vanya, and he did a lot of unusual things. And he empowered a lot of different kinds of people. And I don't mean empowered in any formal way, but he inspired, I think, and touched the lives of very different kind of people. And some are holding their knees, sitting way in a temple, but some are doing very different things. And, you know, I have a little practice group up here in Portland, and we're doing different things. We're heretics, by the way. We sit in a circle facing each other. And we chant in all different kinds of languages, and we do Qigong, and we sit outside. And even though it's not the particular way Koban shared, although some of it is, obviously, but I think Koban's allowance for find your own way is really conducive to that. And I think of, you know, one of his early students was Tim Kennedy. And Tim Kennedy was the first teacher of Brad Warner. I don't know if some people knew Brad Warner, but he at least publicizes and writes in very radical different ways. You know, he never studied with Koban directly, but he's part of that inspiration, I think. And so many different things, you know, things that Vanya is trying that's different. And I think there was a really great variety. And I think that's what Koban wanted. Just everyone find their own way, and it's going to look really different. And let's inspire each other to keep doing that, to find what's vital and dynamic. I think Peter mentioned, like, we're not attracting millennials. I think that should be paid somewhat attention to, because I think it is a trend in a lot of centers these days, a lot of the more conventional centers. But I don't think it's about whether you're Japanese or not. Some young people really love Japanese stuff. I think it's whether there's a sense of dynamism offered, a sense of how to deal with today's very troubled, changing, scary world, and whether we can meet that with some excitement and liveliness and presence. And of course, Zazen teaches to do that, but other forms are I think, are really helpful and necessary as well. So, yeah, I wanted to say that. I don't know if Kokyo was getting to something else, but yeah.
I just wanted to make sure that you could offer something.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. We're bowing to you.
I'm bowing back. I can see. Got a camera working on this computer for a change.
So, yeah, I do. I mean, you made lots of wonderful points, but one thing you said at the beginning that resonated was Koban's famously slow style of talking. And although I never experienced this, my wife knew Koban before I met him. She just had happened to meet him actually at Poreg and at Masahara, that he sometimes spoke so slowly that he himself fell asleep while he was talking. So that's pretty slow.
Yeah, it was a horror event. Yeah, I think I've come close to doing that as well.
Well, I think I've gone on a little longer than I was supposed to. But please, you, go
ahead.
I
just have a quick antidote.
Yes.
Tenzo. There's a young couple, and they would always have their beautiful ham hock, or I don't know what the whole leg thing is called, but every Sunday. And the husband says, why do you cut the end off? I don't know. My mother always did it that way, and her mother did it that way. So they went on every Sunday cooking, you know, cutting that off, cooking it. And then one day, the mother and the mother's mother comes over for dinner. So the husband had a chance to ask, why do you cut the end off of the ham every time? Is there something to this? And she said, well, it's because my oven was only this big. Her oven was only this big.
Dan, to your left, there's been a question.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
You mentioned that the way Coben taught was that he encouraged his students to be in the world, live their lives, have work lives, or do things they wanted, and find a balance with the practice. So my question is that, like, I have had some contradictions about that within me, and any clarifications would help. So if you look at the Buddha, he just like went straight out 6 years in the forest, meditating, studying with various teachers, and then eventually just like trying to figure it out himself, and then reaching the other shore. And then we hear about, you know, Eheji or like other practices where people will put in a lot of effort to confront reality directly, as we say it in Zen and other traditions. And so what is it about finding this balance when we say, you know, like, yeah, live your life and then practice and find this balance? Is it like, are we trying to just like get some of the practice and some of the real world and like try to get everything? Or is it really the case that for some people, living out in the world is the best way to practice rather than the hardcore version of the practice? What is it? And like, and the contradiction happens also because it says that, you know, when we're part of the world, we can't help but create more karma, which creates more entrapment and attachment to the world. Especially like Trungpa Rinpoche talks about it, like the four preliminaries, that you can't help but create more karma, creates more entrapment. And so if you could say more about, you know, like this way of practice, which is where we like try to find this balance. Is it truly a balance? Is it getting everything of something, or is it like truly something that helps the practice?
You know, all the way back to the time of Buddha, he had students who were monastics and he had students who were not. His very first students, Tapusa and Balika, were lay people. They were traveling merchants who heard that he was teaching outside of this village where they happened to be visiting, and they went and paid their respects and became his first disciples. Now when people become disciples, you take these three refuges, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. But they only took two refuges because there was no Sangha yet, so they just took refuge in Buddha and Dharma, and it said that they experienced awakening. And then afterwards they went back and continued to be traveling merchants. And as Buddha was, you know, late in life and recounting his his sort of greatest students, he remembered them. The way that Buddha talked about it, both of these paths were completely possible. He considered the monastic path to be the easy path. Really for the reasons that you gave, that just there's fewer distractions, there's fewer temptations, there's fewer demands on your time, you can spend more time sitting and practicing, and it's easier, I suppose, to overcome some of your attachments. And he considered the lay path to be the more difficult path, because you're trying to do all those same things while you're still in the world and dealing with all of those demands. And I think there's some truth to that, that, you know, it is difficult to practice in the world and to encounter, I think, the inevitable attachments that you talk about while we're trying to practice. And so, you know, I think if somebody wants to lead a monastic life, whether that's going to the Sahara, whether that's going to Japan, whether that's going to Thailand or Burma. No, I think that can be very, very meaningful and can be a very powerful experience. And in many ways is an easier way to focus on the practice. And Koban himself did that for a period of time. He spent a couple years, I can't remember, two, three, at a Heiji, you know, essentially practicing full time. But he spent the vast majority of his life practicing in the world, raising a family, two families, really. He was married twice and had two sets of kids. And doing lots of other things, starting temples, having friends, skiing. That he chose. I think it's easy to be a bit judgmental on both sides. The people who go into the monastic practice often think that those who don't are not sufficiently serious. Those who don't become monastics sometimes think that monastics are running away and sort of avoiding the challenges of daily life. So I try not to be judgmental, and I do see value in both, and I find myself questioning which is the better path for me. I've chosen the householder life, but I sometimes wonder if it's time to spend some time living differently. There used to be a tradition in India where you would lead a householder life, and then when you got to a certain age, you would essentially become a monastic. In Japan, to some extent Thailand, they do exactly the opposite. They do monastic stuff when they're young, sort of like going to college, and then have a householder life. I think we just have to be open to finding our path, doing experiments, learning from our mistakes, and trying our best. You use this word effort, and I do think that's important, that any path requires effort. When Koban encouraged us to go out and lead our life and, you know, maybe get married or have children or have jobs, he wasn't saying that we shouldn't make an effort in our practice at all. I think he would want us to make an effort in all those things. He made efforts, you know, in many things in his life. Again, I don't see this, what's usually called the householder path, as being an easy path. In some ways, it is a harder path. It's at least a more complicated path. And it requires effort. The basic teaching of Buddhism is this middle way, avoiding extremes. And, you know, in some ways that was my answer to Peter, that we're trying to find this middle way between preserving and adapting. And it's also, I think, my answer to you, that we're all finding this middle way between, I don't know, sort of going with the flow and doing what's easy and making an effort to focus on our practice, do something hard. And it's going to look different for different people. I think for many of us, we see monastic life and we think that seems very extreme. That doesn't feel like the middle way. That feels like almost an ascetic life. Some of us look at a householder life and think that doesn't look like the middle way. That looks like just going with the flow and doing what everybody's doing, not being serious. There was, I was living, I lived for a little while at the San Francisco Zen Center, and I was studying a bit with Rebbe Anderson, who was the abbot there at the time. And there was a story that he used to sit Zazen with like a sack of rice on his head so that he wouldn't like fall over and could sit for these long periods. And I thought that sounded nuts. That didn't seem like the middle way. That seemed like too, he was pushing himself too hard. But, you know, for him, that felt like the right balance. That felt like the right amount of effort. So I don't know what the middle way will look like for you. I'm not even sure what the middle way looks like for me. But we just keep trying to find it. And I think that's what, that's in the end what I think COVID was asking us to do.
I know you've been looking at your watch. Colvin wouldn't do that because you could just go on and on. So I'm going to go on with ask for a voice we haven't heard from that hero in this discussion of the cultural adaptation of Zen practice. Probably more than anybody I know, you've straddled the Japanese and American culture. How do you see our practice going here, the direction you followed it for decades? And if you want to pass on that, that's fine. You don't have to say anything.
So I was just reflecting on the Buddha himself. As I understand it, from an art history perspective, the Buddha declared that there should be no images made of him. So obviously, when the first Buddhists began practicing as Buddhists, they were not bowing to an image. And nowadays, you can't have a Buddhist practice without an image. So that's already a complete shift from what the Buddha seemed to feel was important. And of course, we explain it as bowing to our Buddha nature. So I wonder what those monks were first doing when they came together. Certainly, they listened to the Buddha's talk, but what sort of ritual or what sort of... They certainly weren't doing the chanting that we do nowadays, because there were... Those chants initially were all memories of Buddha's talks. So before that, what were they doing other than sitting? So it seems to me it all comes back to the present moment. And you mentioned about our practice is bringing our practice to the moment. So it seems to me that that's what we... We've got to keep our focus on what is our practice as we come to the moment. And if we think a lot about the practice, then are we ruining the moment? Because are we staining the moment with our assumptions about practice? So this moment keeps coming regardless of what we're doing. So my question, I guess, is how are we meeting it?
Well, Peter says I shouldn't look at my watch. So if anyone else would like to speak.
I just want to say one thing quick to the gentleman that I can see straight on this camera. I don't know his name, but the in the world and out the world question. Another way you can understand Madhyamaka or the middle way is you don't make either side. And I think Coben taught this really well. I don't think there was a formal, I mean, there was in a relative sense, and he knew what he was doing, a formal thing, and he was being casual, but I don't think they were separate worlds. I don't think you're in the world and the outer world. I mean, you're in a Zendo now, and another time you're in the office. And I don't think even those categories are useful. And I think that's what one of the heritages we have from Koban that was so strong is all those categories don't even seem to hold anymore. I think what he wanted us all to do is find what we love and just really do what we love. And that's what we can do wholeheartedly, you know? And so some people look, you know, I live a kind of renunciate life. I don't have a regular job and money and that kind of thing. And he really encouraged me with that. He encouraged me to go do monastic training and all that. And other people encouraged to be something else. He was just encouraging us all to do what we love, because that can be our greatest offering. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, maybe that's a good place to stop with doing what we love. So thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.